welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on a podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are in your ears, thanks to oldfootballshirts.com. Well, last Saturday we got outfoxed by the Foxes, with Leicester being probably the best side to visit the Amex this season. It was a game that was not without controversy, though, after ref Mike Dean gave Jamie Vardy another chance to score after Matty Ryan had saved his first spot kick. Also this week, Graham Potter and his black backroom staff have been rewarded for the start to their Albion careers with a two-year contract extension taking them up to 2025. And they will certainly have their work cut out this weekend as we visit the league pace-setters Liverpool, who have yet to lose a game in the league this season. And then, on Thursday, we travel to the Emirates to face an Arsenal side who may well be rejuvenated following the sacking of Unai Emery yesterday. Our point at Arsenal last season was our first away at any of the traditional top six. Can we add to that this week? Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to be joined by the author of the Brighton But Only at Home blog, Jason Thackeray. Well, you're not really writing it very much at the moment, Jason, are you?
No, it's
have you run out of words?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Are you saving all your words for us?
I'm saving all my words for you, yes.
There's a Rene Renard.
I was thinking the other one. Was it Whitney Houston?
Saving all my love for you.
Yeah, saving all my words for you. Okay. Yeah. That's very kind of you, though, Jason.
That's one way of not talking about a Leicester game. Let's talk about, Dionne Warwick, who's at the Dome next year. But yeah.
Is she?
Yeah.
Blimey. Have you seen who's at Love Supreme next year?
I must be blind.
No, there's the Ainsley brothers are playing. I was going to say Jose Feliciano. It's not. No, Sergio Mendes. Wow, brilliant.
Doesn't he play centre midfield for Bolton?
There's a tumbleweed going past the window.
We did actually use his music as our theme tune for a while, actually, during the Brazilian World Cup.
Oh, that one, yeah. Mascanada.
That's the one.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the bloke's still going.
Christ, he must be about...
He must be 90, easily.
Does he have another song?
Loads, yeah. Well, he's massive... In Brazil, I was going to say that's, yeah.
Is that because he's had a lot of pies or?
No, what? I mean, no.
Well, yeah. Okay. Moving swiftly on then. Jason, thanks for coming back in again. Nice to see you. What have you made of Graham Potter so far?
Graham Potter so far, definitely more positives than negatives. I still enjoying possible. I think we have had one or two off days. We'll talk about Leicester a little bit later because. I think we were just genuinely beaten by a better side, but we can go
we'll talk about that in a minute.
This is the start. I said this.
Are we relegation candidates?
Everyone's a relegation candidate that isn't in the top four.
Are we?
It's too tight to not say we're not.
Okay, let's put it this way: are we in a better position to be playing a fourth season than we were maybe playing a third season?
Yes, I think we are.
What makes you think that?
I think that we will pick more points up. I think we have two sides in Watford and Norwich who'll definitely go down. So there's probably only one other place to play for.
Uh-huh.
But it's painfully tight in the middle pack at the moment, and a bad run can see you drop down.
I think we had two wins that took us from something like 16th to 8th, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. And obviously, we are talking about Graham Potter's contract extension here. And by his own admission, he said, it's a little strange. We haven't done anything yet, which is true. And, you know,
It's a manager being given a five-year contract right from the beginning, isn't it? All bar 13 matches.
But, I mean, I was confused by this. I was trying, like I said, I mean, you don't... I thought maybe Judge come Christmas time, but release halfway through the season, and I was just trying to work it out. I was actually doing another show this week, and I was chatting to them about that. And all of a sudden, there was a sound of the penny dropping in my own head as I was talking about it. It was obviously with Graham, there's a long term vision here,
sure.
And the fact that he's already started bringing through players from the U team, and the fact that they've now all got on to like earn full international honours as well,
uh-huh.
And you know, and the investment that's going on in the training ground, and the investment that's going on in the team, basically what the club is seeing, they're protecting their investment, and they're seeing that he's prepared to do all of this. He's seeing the players being coached and becoming better players, and let's not forget this is largely still Chris Hughton's side here. So,
well, but also talking about his ongoing stability. And for everyone to grow together. I mean, there will be players here who, that if assuming that Potter will see his contract out, and it's a massive assumption because, let's face it, managers don't generally last 5 years, especially unless you're actually, I was about to say, unless you're, well, Leicester won the title, you know, against all odds, and their manager was gone in no time at all. This is about, yeah, all, everyone working together, growing together, and being together. Mm. It'd be astonishing if he did sort of see out his entire 5 year contract.
Yeah, for sure. But Jason, there is an air of cynicism, which has got to creep in here. I mean, we're at that time of the year where clubs are starting to look at their managers and think, actually, he's not for us. It's just happened this week with Arsenal ditching Unai Emery, which happened way too early. They couldn't have waited until another next week. Could they?
Yeah, I know.
But it was, Everton
is looking. Do you take the view? I think it's been slightly poo pooed, Jason. But do you take the view that this is about actually the Albion saying, you know, a hands off to everyone else?
No, I don't. It strengthens our position when the magic managerial merry-go-round goes on. But I think there's more to it than that. I think it's a vote of confidence from Tony Bloom and particularly from Dan Ashworth as well. I think Bloom and Ashworth have liked what they've seen and they want to keep it.
Yeah, I mean, Tony was telling us, Al, when we interviewed him recently, about his faith in Graham.
Yeah, and that's why I listened to that show, and that's kind of where that's what's informed.
I think the thing that sort of scratches people's heads, and I take Graham Potter's point here is that we haven't done anything yet. Now, when Chris Hughton got his first contract extension, he'd done something, and I think his first one, I could be wrong, was when we just missed out on promotion.
Yeah, the first thing they did was secure him for another year.
Well, absolutely. Now, he already had 3 years, and we've now secured him up to, what was it, 25 past eight? It was something like that. Something absolutely, you know, it sounds bananas.
He's a modest man as well, though, Graham Potter, because, I mean, you say he's done that. He's turned Aaron Connolly into a full Irish international. He's beaten
about
Spurs
3-0. Flat. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's not been without its highlights.
Well, this is it, but I think it's also allowing Graham Potter to develop for himself as well. I mean, he's all right. He had 8 years in Sweden, but you know, in with Swedish football, if you're going to compete on the world stage, you're only going to be able to take something so far. So he went to Swansea. Okay, fine. An excellent stepping stone to working in British football. Got to see what was going on. I think the leap has been quite huge. You know, I mean, Swansea fans were saying, well, you know, as much as we wanted to keep him, you know, you'd have said, let's have another year and let him really sort of get his stuff, you know, get his teeth into what he's doing. And he's actually almost learning on the job in the Premier League, which is actually a frightening prospect. If you really want to have this proper notion of Premier League survival, you've got to do it with the proper tested, respected sort of people. All right, it's happened where the likes of Eddie Howe, who had zero experience in the Premier League, you know, he's obviously done very well. And he's not alone in doing it. I think Sean Dyche is still in his first Premier League job. But, you know, when you've got someone who is actually doing this for the first time and he's learning on the job, I think it's actually Tony Bloom.
But those guys, they earn the right to manage in the Premier League by being promoted to the Premier League. This is us taking a chance on a player.
Well, that's what I mean. It's a massive... It is, in comparison to what they've done, it's a massive leap. And to actually then give him 5 years just because he's done very well in the first third is, you know, it's... We know that Tony's a professional person and he understands the concept of risk and reward. But, you know, it's brilliant. He's really put his faith in Graham Potter. And, you know, and I think that we know that it's still a work in progress.
Yeah. But Jason, he still only had one transfer window as well.
He didn't too shabbily in that.
Well,
did he?
He's actually come out on record this week and said he's not too interested in the January window. Well, that's probably just lip service. But
Brighton managers always say that because Tony Bloom doesn't like doing his business. Then,
well, no, but I mean, I suspect we'll probably see more go out than come in. Would you say?
I would suspect we will see more go out than come in. I think the one thing that we could bring in, or I'd like to see us bring in if we possibly can, is a right back that's not Martin Montoya, basically.
You don't like him, do you?
Funnily enough, when I was on the show a couple of months ago, I thought that Potter Ball had actually been quite good for him because he was thriving on the attack. I think the thing with him, I can't remember who it was who posted this on NSC, but it's very, very true, is he played for sides in Spain that were used to attacking and having the ball. So he's very comfortable going forward, but he's really not had a lot of experience defending and he's getting taken to bits at times.
But, myself and a real regular Andy Bass were having this conversation this week and we're saying...
Were you squiffy at the time?
No, we were not.
Really?
No, we were not.
Oh,
it was not even in the public house. It was actually by email. We're actually saying that Bernardo, he's not really had much opportunity through injury this year.
Yeah.
But again, he's one that should fit into the concept of possible.
Would you want him? Yes. Would you want him in place of Montoya on the right? I mean, been playing left back, but
he's not a left back; he's a right back. So he's much better on that side. He's a lot more comfortable there. You've also got Scalotto who could come in there as well, and he's been first change at the moment. So
I can't help feeling that Scalotto is a little bit of a like for like with Montoya. A similar thing of used to being sort of with the ball rather than defending.
I'd rather see a left back come in. That's what I'm looking at. We haven't really got one apart from Gaëtan Bong. We've been playing Solly March there. Come on.
The thing is, that's the nature of 5-3-2s. I mean, certainly
the people that have played there so far, Dan Byrne,
yeah,
who's 8'2" when he's lying down.
Yeah,
you got and Solly March.
Well,
Solly
March hasn't. I don't think he's played left back.
Played there as well.
Yeah, yes. So there's clearly room for improvement on that side. And Solly, bless him, he's not quite hit his straps yet this season. But we know that player's there, and I think he will thrive under Graham. But it's just going to take a little bit more time with him.
No, it's interesting. So when we talk about the Leicester game, I want to talk about Solly March because I totally agree with that.
Well,
point.
let's go to the Leicester game now then. And there was three changes from the side that was beaten at Old Trafford, with Adam Webster back in for the suspended dunk. Solly March came in for the knackered Stephen Elzate, mm-hmm. who after jet lag, Stephen Elzate that mm-hmm. is probably, and Aaron Moy came in for Pascal Gross, which I was a bit surprised about, actually. I thought we might play Gross and Moy in this game, but...
Well, we had Stevens, Proper and Moy, so you don't want Gross. Do you want Gross as well?
We've been playing the 4-2-2, too, haven't we? So we've been playing with two number 10, so that would be certainly... And that certainly worked against Aston Villa, right. Although we lost, so I can't say it worked.
No.
Can
I? But, no idea what you're talking
myself
about
out.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've been playing the 4-2-2-2 formation. We've done that quite a lot this season already, so... Yeah. And we've
but
looked
that makes
effective.
It sound like a rigid formation, and when you're watching with Graham Potter's side, it's far more fluid than that.
Yeah,
well, it's not to say everyone sort of just goes around and does their own thing like a Sunday kickabout,
yeah.
But it's far more fluid than that. To actually come up with a notion of a formation, you know, you might as well try and describe a car crash.
But Jason, we know that Leicester were going to be dangerous in the counter attack, and I think in the first half, what we tried to do is play with play very very deep. And try and not leave any space in behind, and that was certainly working. But they just found another way of playing.
Well, yeah, they did. Even then, in the first half, I think Leicester were all over us. I mean, and they were trying to play on the counter. I noticed we a lot of the time we had three centre backs. A lot of that time, there were gaps between the left, the centre, and the middle. And Jamie Vardy was just standing in that gap the whole time. We actually watched Vardy in the first half, and he was constantly in space. And when you're as quick over the first 5 yards as he is, and then you're continuously quick after that, you play on the break more often than not. But even they're just knocking the ball into him, he was in that gap an awful lot.
I mean, a constant live wire was Harvey Barnes, and if he could actually shoot... then we could have been in serious trouble.
I think we did a number on Maddison and Vardy, but I think it left Barnes alone a little bit. I mean, obviously the first 20 minutes, I mean, they hit the bar, they were having a little bit of fun, and we were missing, I think, certainly the organisational skills of Lewis Dunk. I mean, it's incredible how much someone's stock rises when they're missing by how much you realise how much they are missing. A number of people say, oh, we're missing Dale Stevens when he doesn't play. Well, hello. You know, that's what he brings to the team, and people don't necessarily realise that.
But that chance where they did hit the upright was all down to Solly March ball watching, basically.
Do you want me to get started on Solly March?
Go on.
Okay. I thought his...
How long we got?
Well, yeah. I thought he... Well, did he... I think once during the whole game did he get the ball in. He was kind of the blockage. The ball was getting to him. His approach play, he'd get to the man. His right back had him in his pocket. His body language as the game went on seemed to slump and slump. This is a fella who doesn't seem
Jason,
to be...
You're nodding.
I'm nodding. I thought March had a nightmare on Saturday. I thought he was our worst player.
11th best, let's be fair. It's unfair to say he didn't look like he wanted to be there, but this is a fellow, because he hasn't been starting a lot, you can understand how
ring
miffed
rusty?
He's getting. Maybe a little bit
possibly,
ring rusty, yeah. I'll buy that. But, you know, he'd be sort of it'd be the one-on-one with the right-back. And you realise that Leicester only needed to put one on him because he wasn't getting any change out of him whatsoever. And as the game went on, I think when there was a couple of substitutions and then the formation changed a little bit, he had a better time of it and got the ball in a couple of times. But apart from that, everything just seemed to stop with him and the shoulders were slumped and he didn't look like he was enjoying it. I could be wrong and I could be being totally unfair, but from when you're 70 yards away up in the gods in the West Stand upper, it doesn't look that great.
One man he didn't have an off day was Matty Ryan, and he was magnificent all game, really. I mean, it was there was a fantastic save, and we mentioned Jamie Vardy there, but I mean Chilwell, who was given the keys to the city, for want of a better phrase, he was allowed to roam, and he looked he's on a rich vein of form at the moment, which is a long way that continued, because he looked great for England as well.
Absolutely.
Didn't he?
Chilwell,
yeah,
just not against us.
Yeah,
it's too late for that now.
No, it's a bit late. Yeah,
but I mean, it was his cross that put it on a plate for Vardy. But then we actually started, towards the end of the first half, we started creating some chances. In our first corner of the game, Duffy, who came into the game with a 50p head.
He missed a sitter. He was unmarked. He got three of his man. He was on his own.
Couldn't get over it, could he?
Well, he was over it. It was just so poorly done. I don't think he even jumped from memory. I don't think he even jumped. It was very, very similar to the goal that Lewis Dunk scored against Manchester United, right in front of the goal, completely left alone, and he fluffed his lines. Yeah. I mean, your point is absolutely right. I don't think we necessarily started creating chances apart from that one. I think it's more we actually sort of worked them out a bit and nullified them. And I thought, well, Leicester, if they're that good, they'd actually de-nullify our nullification, and they didn't. So in the towards the end of the first half, it was actually, from a neutral's point of view, probably a very boring first half.
I don't think it was.
I think once we got back into it is what I mean.
Yeah. But I mean, then second half we changed slightly, and we allowed them in behind. Now, we talked about the corner there, which Aaron Moy took, and he put it on a plate for Shane Duffy. That was probably the only corner of note by him. Well, I say of note, the other corners of him were absolutely shocking, and they counterattacked on all of them.
Yeah, they did, and that's how they got the first goal, isn't it? So.
Well, the thing was, I mean,
it's not as though they weren't warned. We weren't warned.
No,
shades of Bournemouth. Do you remember Bournemouth scored four of their five goals before you completely explode, AD? Bournemouth scored four of their five goals against us from breakaways. It was very, very similar to that. And we never learnt our lesson. I mean, it's interesting you're blaming Moyes. They were floaters rather than pingers or flyers.
I am solely blaming him. And
you can't.
Well, basically, okay, explain this to me, right? So you've got Johnny Evans, who's one of their best defenders. Actually, Sonku was wonderful as well for them.
But
Johnny Evans, one of the best defenders. They've only conceded eight goals this season, so that, you know, they're not conceding a lot of goals. So he picks up a knock. He has to go off injured. And so we take the corner with Johnny Evans off the pitch. So we've got one of the best attackers of the ball at a corner in Shane Duffy. We've got 6'9". Dan Byrne. What do? He wazzes it over to the apex of the penalty box for someone to volley back in again. When they've got their best defender not on the pitch.
Yeah.
Now that is just
crazy.
Stupid.
Well, it's not stupid, because against Spurs it did work. Well, nearly worked. I mean, it was exactly the same type of corner where Stevens is on the edge of the area. It's just that it was a better taken corner because Stevens could ping it, and he nearly took that Spurs defender's head off. But it was just so... You're quite right in as much as it was poorly floated rather than pinged across to Stevens.
Well, no,
but I don't have a problem with the fact that he actually did it, because the rest
when
of the defence...
When they're down to 10 men for that corner and they've got their biggest and best defender watching it from the sidelines,
This really frustrated me as well. So my son, who the blog was partly about, wasn't at the game on Saturday. He had flu, so I took my brother. And we were going slightly apoplectic at this point because
one of
the points when you play three at the back, you've got three big centre-backs, or even if you play Dan Burn at left-back, is you should be winning the ball in the air from corners and set pieces. You should be using your fast players, using that ball possession, using that transition that we've got, winning set pieces, banging three big lads up there and knocking the ball in from... And Trossard can deliver a brilliant ball as well.
My issue from corners wasn't so much about the quality of Moyes' ones. They weren't as great as they weren't as good as Gross's ones, obviously. But it's not that; it's the second ball. I mean, so many times, obviously. I mean, we get excited about a corner coming in, and how many corners goals are ever scored from corners? Not that many. So the corner comes in; it's headed away or it's defended. And then, in theory, if it's a head away, you'll have this kind of curtain outside the area of the players who haven't gone into the box. And it's usually someone like Stevens, and Montoya is usually the fella at the back. Trossard might be in there because he's not a big fella, and so on. So you've got this curtain. But it's the second ball as it was coming out. That's what we were losing, and that's when Leicester were pinging away. And a couple of times, and there was Webster did it, and there was March that did it. They just weren't concentrating on what was doing. So that the whilst the corner itself, you can have a gross corner which is headed away, but the second ball is dealt with properly. The fact that a Moy corner is not dealt with by the second ball isn't down to Moy. It's down to those players on
your decision making at that particular moment in time. That was not the corner to play. You've got to have you've got to be creative. You've got to look at read the match situation. You've got to look and see what's going on. The fact of the matter that they counter-attacked and Matty Ryan had to be at his very best to save it, it then happened again, and they actually did score that time from an identical wafty corner. It was frustrating because we knew what they were going to do. We knew they had you don't give them the opportunity to break.
It's not
like
so much about what any team would have done. That it's just that because we actually dealt with the corner so poorly from the second ball, the first one that comes out should be a Brighton player that gets it.
Okay, well let's just leave that one there because it's like we're gonna.
I'm really not blaming the corner taker. They weren't great corners, but I'm not blaming the corner taker.
Well, yeah, the whole team's culpable, but it was the wrong decision-making to do that.
At that time with Evans off the field, it was.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, they did score, though, from a wafty corner that should have been defended better. And left us cold at the back. And Vardy broke like 100 miles an hour, put it on a plate. Matty Ryan had no chance. Right, okay, that's 1-0. We should have had a penalty, right? So,
yeah, fine, yeah.
Nil more pie, discuss.
From where I was in the West Upper, I kind of half went up for it. But it didn't, and I know we're going to come onto this again, it didn't look very much different to the one that Mike Dean gave at the other end. That's if that wasn't a penalty, then neither was theirs. I think that was my probable take on it. I mean, he got a bit of the ball and he got a bit of more power.
No, he didn't. That's the point. Mike Dean clearly signalled that he got the ball, and you could see that clearly afterwards that he didn't. And that's
why hasn't VAR picked that up then?
Well, therein lies the issue, isn't it? I mean, if the clear signal is no, he got the ball, he's then telling VAR, it wasn't enough of a foul. I've no idea what that means. We have to work on supposition here that you don't know the conversation going on between the referee and the VAR. They are talking to each other. They're chirping to each other on just about everything all the time.
Rubbish.
Of course they are. You can't say they're
not. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying rubbish. There's no such thing as like a bit of a foul.
No, there isn't. But no, it has to be enough of a foul. It has to cross the referee's threshold of, in his opinion, that it's a foul. Now, the fact that Dean signalled that he got the ball, if that's his defence to say that wasn't a foul because he got the ball, it's wrong because he didn't touch the ball and he could clearly see that. Why VAR didn't pick that up, I don't know, unless they didn't get the signal saying, well, it's not he did get the ball part. I don't know.
This is where it falls down. I mean, they did get a penalty, which is our own making. It's our own fault.
The build up to it was us faffing around.
Stupid.
It was stupid. And actually, of all people, actually, that gave the killer ball away was Davy Prupper.
And it was a weedy, nothing, flashy. Don't ever play that ball in that area of the pitch.
If it's 6-0 up, you know, outside, you know, at the edge of their penalty area, by all means.
But it was one of those. If it's for you, you're saying it's a penalty. If it's against you, you say it's not a penalty.
The one that you're going to compare it against most is not so much the Mopai one, is Connolly's one against Everton. He did get his ankle. He did look as though he was looking for it. And, you know, it's... If you're going by the letter of the law, yes, it was a penalty because he did catch it.
Okay.
If, however, Dean had said no and VAR looked at it, they'd have, again, probably gone with the umpire's call and confirmed a no.
Okay. Now, this is the bit where, obviously, Matt Ryan saves the penalty. This is the bit where it gets a little bit interesting because it's double jeopardy. Now, okay, so there was encroachment. VAR is meant to stop that sort of thing, and that's fine.
Well, it's not there to stop it. It's there to sort of, you know...
To pinpoint. It's happened. I've watched...
What's your beef?
My beef is, basically, it's the correct decision, so I can't have too much... The best thing about it was, actually, the kid that was sat in front of us was... We're all like learning some new choice Anglo-Saxon and questioning Mike Dean's parentage at the time. And this kid who's probably about 11, he got his phone and he actually went onto the IFAB website and actually started showing it. It's right. And it was like, we're incensed. We do not care if it's right or not.
Well, this is the point when stuff like this, unusual things happen. This is when you get to realise that how little quite a few people are sort of not particularly conversant of the laws. You know, there are so many things like, you know.
Well, my beef with it is it's double jeopardy basically because yes, Bissouma had encroached, had Maddison, and Maddison gained an advantage.
Your alternative is either retake the penalty or give the goal. That's the point.
Yes,
that's your choice. So it's not double jeopardy. If it had been saved and then booted out, that would have been that. But it's because the result was the fact it was a goal, you know. So you think, well, you're turning a definite goal into a probable goal. So you're going with the percentages, and that's it. So if anything, the retake was a better decision because if it's not a retake, it's a goal.
I'm still saying boo because it might ding, really, but yeah. Anyway, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are delighted to be brought to you by the wonderful oldfootballshirts.com, and I do have a shirt of the week, which I'm just going to pass over to Jason Thackeray here to have a look at and see if he can describe this wonderful shirt for me.
I've got it already, I think. But
you know what it is.
No, but you carry on describing it.
Well, I'm going to assume there is. Right, it's red. It's got very clearly sponsored by Fiat's and Adidas shirt. And it's completely normal until you get to the sleeves and they look like they've been designed by a zebra on acid.
A zebra on acid? Is that very tasty?
it's very Gaudi.
Yeah.
I was going to say Mondrian.
Mixed pattern, bit of red splodge thrown in. Yeah, maybe it's Jackson Pollock.
That would be complete. I only ever associate with David Seaman's football shirts.
That would be good for diving.
Yeah. Or what was the name of the goalkeeper? René Aguita. He wore some pretty noisy shirts. Yeah. See, that's Jackson Pollock. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Is it Italian?
I'm going to take a punt here. Is that Rotherham?
No, it is not.
Is it not? Looks like it from here.
It is not. Actually, okay. The back of it's actually quite good as well.
Okay,
it's
that's fine. Well, we'll be posting that on the...
Oh, the nonsense continues on the back.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what's not. It's not Mondrian, it's Miro. That's what I was thinking of. Okay. It looks very like Miro. In which case, is it someone from Barcelona?
No, it is not.
Whatever it is, it's from about 1989.
Okay. This is actually the 1990 to 1991 home shirt of Hungarian side Budapest Honved, who are based in Kispest in Budapest, funnily enough. And Honved means homeland defence. Originally formed as Kispest AC, in 1909, they became Kispest FC in 1926 before reverting to their original name in 1944. The team enjoyed a golden age during the 1950s when it was renamed Budapesti Honved and became the Hungarian Army team. The club's top players from this era were Ferenc Puskás, Sándor Kocsis, Joseph Bosic, Zoltán Krizsbor and Gula Krosics, who formed the nucleus of the legendary Hungarian team known as the Mighty Magyars. And they helped the club win the European League four times during the 1950s. And they play at the 8,000 capacity Hiraguti Anandor Stadium.
8,000?
8,000, yeah. It's not very big.
That's smaller than Wigan ended up.
Yeah. Hang on, this is one of the mighty teams of Europe.
It is. But it may have been reduced by then. But like many teams, they had other sporting teams like wrestling and athletics, boxing, tennis, and later a water polo team, which would be very Jackson Pollock. But there's no notable Albion links, but former Bolton and Liverpool striker David Ngoe currently plies his trade for the Kiss Pest. And the British pop group Half Man Half Biscuit have a song entitled...
I was a teenage armchair Honved fan.
Yeah, there it was, indeed.
Okay. And I sold both Dukla Prague shirts and Honved shirts to Half Man Half Biscuit fans when I had my shop. 12 years ago.
There you go. So, okay, so that's your show of the week.
That's because Phil's in Hungary, that's why, isn't
it? It is, Check it out. So check out on oldfootballshirts.com.
I wonder what he feels about Budapest. Does he feel the same way about Prague? Shall we find out later?
I'm sure we will, judging by the amount of holiday porn we're getting from him at the moment.
Oh, we're getting it step by step. It's every 10 minutes.
Okay, obviously we are playing Liverpool this weekend. A bit of a tough ask for us. And they're, you know, unbeaten in 43 games at the moment. And Al.
43, yes.
Al, you caught up with the Anfield Wrap earlier today.
Yes, Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Wrap. And I was on their show earlier and I had an with him.
Neil, how are you?
Very, very good indeed. And I just want everyone to know, listening to this, that I tell you what, Alan very much fights Brighton's corner on our show all the time. So I hope I match up here, really. Bit of pressure on me.
Well, someone's got to, you know. Just very quickly, before we get started, tell us what the Anfield Wrap is.
So we started right the way back in 2011, and from there we tried to do an online magazine. So we started the Anfield Wrap, we started the podcast, and then we were doing two shows a week. We did one with Radio City Talk, and if you come to Liverpool tomorrow, that's the Big Tower, which is like a mushroom that sits above Liverpool's skyline. That's the City Talk Tower. And then from there, in about 2015, we decided that we'd like to do a premium service. So we started to do a subscriber-based podcast. So we went from doing two a week to 14. And now we find ourselves in a situation where we're doing video as well. So we've got the website with the writing, the audio and the video. If anyone's interested, there's an app that's free that you can download. And all the stuff that we do for free is just accessible on there. And then if anyone did, you know, I suspect your listeners are very Brighton and Hove Albion focused. But if they ever did want to listen to anything, there's some tokens to spend. And then if they wanted to subscribe, which is unlikely, but if they did, then they can do so through there. So, you know, it's fantastic. It's a real joy to be able to do. And it's a real, you know, it's nice to be able to put over an interpretation of Liverpool that's done very much from the city and from the city centre and spread that out for the world.
Absolutely. That's quite a marketing patty you've got there. I mean, I think you probably also told that to a few people. Now, your season, I mean, it's obviously been a long time since you won the league. I mean, let's forget the fact that Liverpool have never won the Premier League. I don't count that as actually a real thing. So this is so far probably the best season, the best chance you've had. I mean, it was toe-to-toe with Man City last season. But at the moment, you've set the pace. You come flying out of the traps. Notwithstanding, obviously, it's great for you, but what's the difference between last year and this year?
To be honest, I don't think there is a great deal of difference, and that's not me being sort of facetious about it. Last year, Liverpool get 97 points from a possible 114, and so far, you know, Liverpool are in a situation where they've got 37 points from a possible 39. My point here is that at some point, Liverpool are going to drop a few points again, but I think we are, you know, it's safe to say, I think we're on course for another season that where we get a points total between 95 and 102. So in one sense, not much has actually changed in terms of the results and in terms of the character this football team shows, but also the quality. You know, it's you know, for your listeners, it's an absolute joy at the minute to support this side. They're a great side and they've got so much going through them. And there's strength in depth, there's goals wherever you look, and then there is that sort of ability to pull it out from the fire, which they've done a few times this season. I'd say maybe a few too many times by this stage of proceedings. I think Liverpool could do with calming down a little bit and beginning to pull away from sides. You know, all these last-minute winners, they're great in theory, but, you know, at some sort of point you can't go to that well.
A win to win, isn't it?
Yeah, but you can't keep going to that wall, that well, Alan. You know, at some sort of point, a side's going to find a way. And, you know, you can make an argument. Napoli do that against us midweek. But all this is me being churlish about a team that's won 12 out of 13 league games this season. It's a great side, and it's a side that's not going to stop being great anytime soon.
So, you know, looking forward to this weekend's game. You know, you, like I say, you've had your game. It was a tough. The extra thing you've got is that you haven't gone into the last Champions League game already having qualified. So there's an extra game that you're going to have to sort of play rather than sort of like just turn up at. So is this going to affect the mindset, you know, for the game against Brighton, do you think?
No, I think that the mindset is what Liverpool are brilliant at. And more than any side I've ever seen, really, they play both games in general and then situations they find themselves in. Absolutely magnificently. It's a side that, you know, in terms of its mental approach, in terms of how it deals with setbacks, I've genuinely never seen the like. It's up there with, you know, Ferguson's Manchester United at the very best. And I think that, you know, I'm not...
That must hurt to say that.
No, I mean, it did then, but it doesn't now because you're getting to live it now. All that talk that we used to do that United were lucky or that they get late goals or anything like that. I mean, you know, I'm watching this Liverpool team right now and they're not lucky. One of the annoying, pervading narratives... I'll tell you what, we were lucky against Crystal Palace, but what that was a real example of the media crying wolf.
You're not allowed to swear on the Albion roll. Please be careful with that.
Genuinely, we were lucky against Crystal Palace, but it was the only game where I think we've been fortunate this season. You know, everyone talked about the Sheffield United game as an example, but Sadio Mane missed an open goal from 6 yards with the keeper out and hit the outside of the post at 0-0. Yes, the keeper makes a mistake later on in the game, but Liverpool have had 3 clear-cut chances by then, and by clear-cut, I mean must-score chances. You know, there's been a desire to act as though this is a lucky Liverpool side, but it genuinely isn't, Alan. And, you know, as I say, Palace was the first time I've come away from a game this season feeling like we've got away with one there. They can't play any better than that, and they got beat, and that should be a heartening for you and your listeners. And I actually expect Brighton to finish ahead of Palace this season. But ultimately...
We fully expect it. Whether it's going to happen or not is another matter, but, you know, we fully demand it, certainly. So what's... I mean, obviously, you know, you do actually watch a lot of the Premier League. Obviously, you have your show and it talks about a lot of other teams and how they're doing. And you know, we've been on the show, you know, I've been on your show for the last 2 or 3 years. And, you know, when we were a Championship side and we were knocking on the door so much. So what's the Anfield rap? And maybe the Liverpool fans generally, but what's the Anfield rap's take on Brighton this season?
On Brighton this season, I think that there's a few people who are going to become surprised at the weekend. I think that at the minute, Brighton actually, I don't think I've had enough time on television so far this campaign. I actually think it's been bad booking because I think Brighton are one of the most interesting teams in the country. And whenever I've seen them, you know, I was in a very crowded pub as you were taking dismantling Tottenham. And there was a few discussions and almost gasps of astonishment around the quality that Brighton have had. And I actually think you're the side in the country that's possibly been worse served by television so far this season in terms of being able to say to people, there's something interesting happening here. I think that's what's been missed a little bit. Trust me, you know, there was a lot of Liverpool supporters delighted with you turning that game round against Everton. That's part of what we're all in it for. But I think that this is a Brighton side that firstly people are going to see more of in the second half of the season. And secondly, the thing I've been saying on our show to people is there'll be a point at the game on Saturday where the fellow next to you will nudge you and he'll say these can play a bit. And I think that the people who are switched on, who are watching a lot of other Premier League football, are aware of that already. Those who aren't will be by 5 o'clock on Saturday, no matter what the result is. People are going to be saying these can play a bit.
I mean, well, I think that if we're talking about tally, I think we're going to be flooded over Christmas. I think about four or five of our games before the FA Cup, you know, whatever our FA Cup third round game is going to be on the telly. I mean, you know, we've got a 12:30 kickoff on New Year's Day. I know it's a local game, but you know, no game should not be played on New Year's Day. It should be against the law. That's another matter entirely. But if we're going to change subject, I mean, obviously there's sort of the darker side that we have to talk about. I mean, when we were on the show earlier, and I'd have loved this week on your show earlier this week, I would have loved to talk about it, but you know, there was the verdict in the David Duckenfield trial. Now, obviously, we have to be careful because there's still one or two perjury trials to come up, so we have to be careful. But we're allowed to talk about this trial. What we've clearly seen on the news is that the Hillsborough families are very, very disappointed. But in the great scheme of things, how's the whole thing how is it all manifesting itself across the city, and how is it manifesting itself across the club? You know, this verdict.
People are upset, and I think it's you know, I don't want to almost talk too much about this trial anyway. I mean, we can now talk about it to a certain extent, but it is worth sort of saying that I always feel, in any level of media, if you're not in a courtroom, it's difficult to want to talk about a trial and feel as though you can do so from a certain position. But it's worth saying that what this means is that ultimately the inquests have come in and it's been made very, very clear that there was an unlawful killing. But what this now says is that there will not be anyone's name attached to that unlawful killing. Now, you know, I can speak for myself. I think it's also important to always say that one of the things about the Hillsborough families is there's a and the survivors for that matter, there is a determination, certainly outside Liverpool, but also at times inside Liverpool, to act as though they're homogenous. And the situation is, as would be with 96 disparate families and with 3,000 survivors, it's much more complicated than that in terms of what people think. But one of the things here is it does seem as though it just feels like the denouement, because whilst there is the perjury trials to come, this does feel in a sense like the denouement of this process as being yet another defeat for those who seek justice around what happened in 1989. And I think that that's, you know, I mean, something as simple as the fact that no one thought the verdict was coming in this week, to be honest with you. You know, I do what I have to do around the media stuff, and everyone thought, oh, it'll be next week at the earliest. And, you know, it's almost caught everyone off guard in a sense. And I think that there is still this thing, the thing that you've actually just said there about the fact that we've still got to be careful. And I think that that's something that hurts the families and hurts survivors, that even now, Liverpool supporters and the families and the survivors, we've all still got to watch what we do and what we say. And we still can't, you know, I think for those families, when I say we, for those families and for those survivors, they still can't properly and publicly grieve. And the reason why is because no one wants to jeopardise other proceedings. And all the way through this, what I think the dignity, and without, at times, I think people use phrases like quiet dignity in a manner which I think is quite patronising. But the dignity that's been shown over a very, very, very long term by Liverpool supporters, by survivors, by people who know survivors and by families and people who know families has been absolutely staggering in complete comparison to the establishment. We're not talking about, it's not so long since the then Prime Minister David Cameron described the pursuit of truth as being the act of a blind man in a dark room looking for a black cat that isn't there. And he subsequently had to apologise, and had to apologise on behalf of the British state, but also had to apologise for having said that. And he felt he was in a position where he could say that. And whilst proceedings and actions and legal cases and all things have been ongoing, people have really, really, really watched their mouths. There's all that thing, don't say this on social media, don't say that on social media. And Liverpool supporters say that to each other all the time. And I do think that there is something here where what we've done is we've silenced the victims through legal procedure for a long period of time. And I accept why that's important, and I accept that we don't want to prejudice trials, and I accept there is a process to go through. But actually, with this process, one of the things that's happened is that we have impacted upon people's ability to grieve after the independent panel report, to grieve after the inquest verdict, and now there's this. And in this instance, and as I say, without commenting in any specifics on the trial, because I was not sat every single day through those hearings listening to everything that came through, but to feel as though yet again everyone on the side of the families and of the survivors has acted properly, but justice as it would be generally perceived to be hasn't been done, it hurts. And it really does hurt, and it hurt the city. And I'll be really honest with you, Alan, it really knocked me to one side yesterday. And I work here at the Anfield Rap, and I've got young people looking at me, and I've got to be able to, you know, I had shows to do at 4 o'clock when the verdict came in, and we had to put them all to one side for a period, and then we all had to have a bit of a conversation about what we could and couldn't say. And, you know, and as I say, I was 9 years old, and, you know, when the disaster happened, my uncle was there. But I'm trying to articulate something here, but, you know, I've got these young people looking at me and I'm trying to say some words, and it is as simple as, you know, there's part of you that wants to say, listen, there'll never be, you know, there's been the pursuit of justice, and the one thing we have got and the one thing we've got to cling to, and the one thing why it's important that, for instance, your show and people like you talk about it, is we've at least got truth. 30 years on, could there ever have been genuinely justice? So many people who've been involved in what's gone on there have passed away subsequently. You know, could there ever have been genuine justice? I think that's a complicated question. But what happened yesterday and when the verdict came in, it did genuinely feel like a kick to the stomach, to be honest with you. And as I say, that's not to say that those jurors have made the wrong decision or anything like that, but it does feel as though this is towards the end of this process. And any notion that what went on in 1989, which it has been decided was unlawful, The idea there will ever be individuals or institutions genuinely held to account has gone. And I think that's a remarkably bleak position to be in, but it is the position that we've all been in. And just to pull it back to the here and now, or as close as we can to the here and now, it's why I think it's really important that collectively we have a think about how we can support, as an example, victims of tragedies like Grenfell, and support them in terms of... One of the things that I think institutions have plans for when things go wrong. So in a really basic way, and I've been talking here for a while, and I don't want to be boring your listeners, but in a really basic way, one of the documents from the Hillsborough Independent Panel report, one of the things it pulled was that the legal fees for the FA in the 6 months after the disaster happened, the cost of the photocopying in 1989, the cost of the legal photocopying that was done by the FA's lawyers in 1989 ran into six figures. Six figures. And my point this is that the FA, the disaster happens and there's 96 lives and there's 2,500, 3,000 people, maybe even more, with something that we'd now recognise as post-traumatic stress disorder. But the FA, as a corporate entity, is able to move into action to the extent that it's legal. People do this, 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 and this. Well, normal people, Alan, you know, you will have a lawyer that you've worked with at some point, but that lawyer could not deal with something like this at short notice. But they had lawyers, and they had an action plan. And institutions, and you've only got to see it in the aftermath of Grenfell, institutions and public bodies have action plans when disasters happen, but normal, real people don't. What they have is devastation. And I think that all of this now, for me, one of the key things I think to take away from Hillsborough, which should be taken forward in British society, and we'll be really clear to your listeners, Hillsborough is not a sporting tragedy, it's not a football tragedy, it is a national scandal and a national tragedy. It should be taken out of this arena completely, but sadly it gets locked back into this arena, because what you see is that the only way in which people feel they can articulate themselves properly is at football matches, because we do not have, as normal humans, the ability to respond to extreme crisis in a corporate sense, where as corporate bodies do, and systems are rigged in their favour. And I think that's the main thing I would take away for everyone to imagine and to everyone to picture, that your whole life is turned upside down, your life is ruined, but they've got the people who are in some way, shape or form you feel responsible. They're able to create an action plan and you're just left with loss and devastation.
Well, Brighton are in town tomorrow. We're looking forward to coming up and seeing you. You will have from us dignified solidarity and support. But it's great to hear from you. Thanks very much indeed for your thoughts, Neil. That's Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Wrap. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
AD.
Okay, well, as some of you may have noticed, we are currently coming to the end of a decade. And it is indeed, and it's been an interesting decade for us, actually. It's been pretty
interesting. It's probably one of our best ever. Hello, we've gone from the worst football ground in England to one of the best. We've gone from the third division, the bottom of the third division, to the Premier League. We've had grown men cry at our at football matches on a monotonous basis. We've had two promotions. Jason, have you had a good time?
In the last day, yeah, it's been amazing.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing. From, you know, if you'd have told me back in the start of 2010 that we'd be in the Premier League coming into 2020,
our third season,
one of the most exciting young English managers in the game, that Vicente would have played for us, that Glenn Murray would have left and come back.
Yes. Okay.
We're going to have a look at the players and try and come up with our team of the decade, which I know a lot of other people are doing as well. But we're actually going to have a look at the men between the sticks, the goalkeepers of the decade. Do you want to hazard a guess, Al? How many goalkeepers have played for us this decade in the last 10 years?
Since January the 1st, 2010 to now, first team games, I'm going to guess at 12.
Close.
Go on.
10.
No, 15.
Okay, are you going to go through each?
Actually, technically, looking at this list again, actually, technically, it's actually 14, because one of them
was Lewis Dunk.
if you include Lewis Dunk, actually that's 16. So
you haven't got Lewis Dunk on the list.
I haven't got Lewis Dunk on the list.
He was the first one I thought of.
But there's one fella on here. He was on the bench quite a lot, but he never actually made a first team appearance.
Who was that?
Michael Pope.
I did actually. Was he still here in 2010?
Michael Pope wasn't playing for us in 2010, but he did play against us in the very first game of 2010, which was a 1-0 win away in the FA Cup at Torquay. Do you remember who scored?
Nope.
Andrew Cross. So who was your favourite goalkeeper of this decade?
I think your list, you're going to have to make this list first. Quickly go and
Okay, who's made nice appearances, actually, Jason?
Kuchak.
Ankergren.
In the decade, or
in the last 10 years, which goalkeepers made the most appearances?
It must be Stockdale.
It's David Stockdale. Yeah. He's played 140 appearances in his time with us. So the list I've got here is actually there was one surprising one. We were talking about this before the show. I completely forgotten about it. So Al, who played in goal for us away at Barnsley at the end of the 2012 season?
Oh, it was one game. It was Mitch Walker.
No. It was David Gonzalez Girardo, who I'd completely forgotten who played for us. But he played two games for us in April 2012.
He got booed, actually. I remember this now. He got booed in the first few minutes of the game. I think he made a dropsy. He played one game at the Amex. He made a dropsy. He got booed.
He
got booed, and then I think he made a couple of decent saves, and then the North Stand turned around. But I remember it. He was getting grief, and I remember this now.
Because he actually played against us when we beat Barnsley 5-1 as well. So it was, okay. And he had an absolute shocker.
Yeah,
I remember that.
I think that's what people may have remembered.
That's why I remember.
But name. There's been a lot of goalkeepers over that decade, and some of them better than others. If you're talking about the best, you've got to say, would you say Matt Ryan?
It's Ryan.
I have to say Matthew Ryan.
There's no one else.
He's played brilliantly for us at the highest level.
Yeah.
And he can't say better than that. You can say those players who were part of the successful sides. I mean, Kuchak wasn't too shabby. Angergram, was in a successful side. Stockdale was in a successful side. But if you're going to measure it in terms of the level they're playing at and playing well, then yeah, it has to be Ryan.
It's got to be Ryan.
Looking back on it, it does seem to be a really, really bizarre decision by David Stockdale to go after being promoted.
I think somewhere down the line it was kind of understood he wasn't necessarily going to be the first choice goalkeeper.
Yeah, I think that was it.
In which case, if he was going to be the bench warmer, then you can understand his point. And who was it? It was Birmingham. Who was the manager at the time?
Harry Redknapp.
Exactly. Yeah. Offered him silly money. Yeah. Financially cripples Birmingham City. Here we are. He's where is he nowadays? He's still at Birmingham.
It goes out on loan to all sorts of leagues.
He's been everywhere. He's at Southend for a little bit.
Exactly. So. I think the thing with Stockdale was he really struggled with his weight at times. He was grossly out of shape.
What happened when Ben Roberts came in. I think he really sort of shook him up.
Yeah.
Turned him around and turned him to someone new.
He did.
We didn't want him.
I do a lot of running, and there's a running app called Strava where you can follow people and check all your running. And suddenly Stockdale started Stravaing his runs like a madman, and he went from 17 stone to about 14 in no time at all.
And vastly improved.
But when you look at him now, he's back up again. His weight's gone back up. Okay.
But you also look at his first season with us, the calamities between him and Lewis Dunk.
Yeah.
We're absolutely farcical. And yet, and you fast forward to when Chris Hughton came in, and he turned into a, brilliant
Looking back over that decade, obviously there's been some great saves, and as you mentioned, Lewis Dunk going in goal for and keeping a clean sheet as well, which is amazing. We've asked this question out on our social media this week, and the one that keeps coming back in terms of the saves David Stockdale's double save against Sheffield Wednesday.
That was instantly going to be what I said. That is my favourite save of the decade by a long, long way.
Well, one, because of the context. The context was everything. Glenn Murray had just been sent off, and I know you're going to start raving about that, but we don't have time. Murray had just been sent off. It's Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah, exactly.
It's Forestieri.
Yeah.
The horrible little squit. He's still there, isn't he? It was the context and those gobby horrible people and stopped. Initially, when I remember that penalty save, I saw the save, but I didn't realise until I saw it afterwards that he'd actually... I thought that he just scuffed it wide. I didn't realise that Stockdale had tipped it around the post. Yeah.
But also probably responsible for the ricket of the decade as well.
Yeah, the biggest howler at Villa.
Yeah, and cost us the trophy.
I really
hate that when they say cost us the trophy. Sorry, that bloke. I think he got us the champion. He got us promoted. You know.
He was responsible. But basically, we're 1-0 up in 89th minute. And
oh, you drop a
I think you could also say the entire team going on a 3-week bender cost us the trophy.
Well, there is that.
I mean, we should have done it at Bristol City.
I was about to say we should have won already. So to blame one person, I actually find that appalling.
But also, we have to talk about the art of time wasting. And who am I talking about?
Pick one.
They all do it.
The master of it was Kasper Anckarken.
He did
was
do it very well.
Yeah, he did actually.
He did. I think, but having said that, I think it just was that slow.
Okay, but I mean, I'm just going to go through the whole list here. So Matt Ryan, 87 appearances. Jason
that's
Steele.
That's an unlucky number for Australians. You know that, don't you?
Well, he's about to make 88.
Well, that's
so
fine. Okay.
Jason Steele hasn't made. He's only played one cup game so far.
Like
so
Almuth, wasn't it?
Yeah, but David Button, 7 appearances. Tim Krul, only 4 appearances and none in the league. Nicky Mempar, who was with us for absolutely ever.
Yes.
9 appearances.
And I don't recall him letting us down. I thought he did
very,
he was
very great.
Well.
Yeah, he did.
David Stockdale, as I mentioned, 140 appearances. Christian Walton, only 4. Anckarken.
So far.
Only so far. I don't think he's ever going to play for us. But personally,
you reckon?
I'd like to think he would. I'd like to think so.
He's still only 12.
But true.
12.
So Casper, 75. Brezovan, Sexy Pete himself. 60,
2 meter Peter.
61.
How many?
61.
As many as that?
Yeah, he was here for a while. Ali Alhabsi.
2.
1.
1.
One.
It was only one. Basically, we signed him on loan, and then they had to go off and play for Oman, and that's where Christian Walton got his opportunity. So,
okay.
Thomas Kuszak, another great goalkeeper for us, 89 appearances for the Poland goal. Steve Harper, 5 appearances. David Gonzalez Geraldo, 2 games in April 2012. Michael Pope, no appearances. Mitch Walker, only 1 appearance. And who's missing from the list?
Kuipers wasn't on it. He's gone.
Michel Kuipers, 8 appearances this decade. So before he went. So that actually is all we've got time for. So we're gonna look at the defenders next week.
I was about to say, so next week, do let us know who your favourite defenders were. Same questions, your favourite one,
your best
defenders moment, your worst defenders ricket, and a random sort of fact about defenders. And they can be fullbacks or centre backs.
But that's it. That's all we've got time for this week. So thank you to Jason Thackeray. Thank you to the Anfield Wrap. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham. Hopefully we're going to be coming back next week and we are going to be positive. We've got a brilliant competition for you next week as well. So keep your ears and eyes open for that one. And this will be the Avon Roar.